Today on the 21st, President Trump has selected Judge Amy Coney Barrett of the Federal Appellate Court in Chicago to fill the Supreme Court seat of Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg. If confirmed, Coney Barrett could represent the biggest ideological shift for the court in decades. We'll speak with Amy Howe of SCOTUS blog and a law professor who worked with the president's nominee. Then, late in life, Thomas Jefferson used a razor and glue to create his own version of the Bible. He called it the Life and Morals of Jesus of Nazareth, but you could also call it Jesus Without the Miracles. We'll talk to the author of a new book taking a deep look at the so-called Jefferson Bible and ask what lessons Jefferson's edits have for us today. I'm Brian Mackey. That's all coming up today on the 21st, which is a production of Illinois Public Media, airing on WILL in Urbana, WUIS in Springfield, WGLT in Normal, WCBU in Peoria, and WNIJ in DeKalb. But first, the news. Welcome to the 21st. I'm Brian Mackey. Last weekend, we learned of President Trump's pick to replace the late Supreme Court Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg. He selected Amy Coney Barrett, who serves on the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Seventh Circuit in Chicago. If confirmed, she would be the youngest member of the court, potentially serving for decades. And she could also bring with her the biggest ideological shift for the court in decades as well. To talk more about Amy Coney Barrett's background as a judge and what her confirmation could mean for the nation's highest court, we're joined by Amy Howe. She's co-founder and contributor to SCOTUS blog, a nonpartisan website that provides coverage of the Supreme Court. Amy, welcome to the 21st.
Hey, thanks for having me.
I'd also like to welcome Professor Jeffrey Pojanowski. He teaches at the University of Notre Dame Law School, and there he was a colleague of Amy Coney Barrett. Professor Pojanowski was also a clerk to Judge John Roberts on the U.S. Court of Appeals for the D.C. Circuit, and then to Justice Anthony Kennedy on the U.S. Supreme Court. Professor Pojanowski, welcome to the 21st.
Thank you so much for having me.
Listeners, if you want to join the conversation, if you have a question about Judge Amy Coney Barrett or the confirmation process that's still being laid out for her by the U.S. Senate, give us a call. The phone lines are open at 800-222-9455. The number again, 800-222-9455. Amy, I want to begin with you. Can you tell us a little bit about Amy Coney Barrett's background? What is her current role on the Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals in Chicago?
Sure. So she joined the Seventh Circuit in 2017. She'd spent 15 years at Notre Dame Law School before that. And you know, she came to the law school after having spent a few years in private practice in Washington, D.C., after clerking for Justice Antonin Scalia. And when she was accepting the nomination in the Rose Garden on Saturday, she talked about Justice Scalia. You know, she talked about how his judicial philosophy is my judicial philosophy, so I imagine we'll talk about that. You know, she also talked about his friendship with Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg. And it was really interesting. You know, she talked about how she strived to sort of emulate that friendship. You know, she said that they left their disagreements in print, which were fierce, sort of behind them, and really had a wonderful relationship in person. So she, you know, brings sort of a varied life experience to the position if she's confirmed.
Yeah, and she hasn't been on the circuit court for all that long, right? Is there a standard length of time that judges typically serve on appellate courts or other courts before they're tapped for the U.S. Supreme Court?
It really depends, you know. Judges, now Justices Gorsuch and Kavanaugh, were on the courts of appeals for longer, you know, in part because they were both confirmed to the courts of appeals, Judge Gorsuch to the then Judge Gorsuch, now Justice Gorsuch to the 10th Circuit based in Denver, and Justice Kavanaugh to the D.C. Circuit during the Bush administration, the George W. Bush administration, and you know, sort of served through the Bush administration and the Obama administration. But Amy Coney Barrett wasn't nominated to the bench until the Trump administration. So it was a shorter term on the bench. But, you know, 3 years is certainly plenty of time. And, you know, I think between the 3 years on the bench and, you know, 15 years as a law professor, given her background, I don't think anyone really doubts sort of that she's got the intellectual firepower to do the job.
Yeah. So I want to come back to her 3 years on the bench in a moment. But Professor Pojanowski, I want to bring you into the conversation. What was Amy Coney Barrett like as a law professor and colleague?
I mean, I probably sound like I'm in the tank because she's a colleague of mine. But she was fantastic. As a teacher, the students loved her. They voted her professor of the year three times, even though although she was never mean or harsh in class, I think she has kind of an intimidating intellect. So I think she, people would sometimes be a little nervous walking into the classroom. But she's also known as a very thoughtful, generous mentor to her students, and I think she prided herself on not bringing in jurisprudential or ideological axe to grind in her classes. As a colleague, she was fantastic. When I was a junior scholar, I joined the law school about 9.5 years ago. She mentored me on some of my papers very early on. Was very generous with her time. And one thing I've noticed is, being with her at conferences, seeing her at workshops around a people a wide array of philosophical and jurisprudential opinions, people like her and respect her, even if they don't agree with her, because she's got a reputation of being very smart, very rigorous, being very fair, understanding when there's reasonable disagreement, and understanding the other side's arguments pretty well, and not being a result-oriented type of scholar. So she has a lot of respect. She gets a lot of respect along those lines.
Yeah. Well, so of course, even if she is, viewed widely as a well-respected person, a nice person, people are going to be taking a hard look at some of the decisions she's written. And Amy, what can you tell us about some of the opinions she's written on the Seventh Circuit, the federal appeals court based in Chicago, that could come up during the confirmation process?
Sure. I mean, she's written herself, either in as the majority or in dissents, somewhere around 100 opinions. And there's, a wide range of topics, everything from immigration to the Fair Labor Standard Act. And, I think it's important to approach, when you're talking about any judge's opinions, there's some nuance, because when you are a judge on the Court of Appeals, you're bound by what your court has previously said about the issue. And you also have to follow what the Supreme Court has said. Only the Supreme Court can overturn the Supreme Court. Having said that, if she has ruled on or voted in some hot button issues like gun rights and abortion and, the rights of students who've been accused of sexual assault at a university. And so you do get a little bit of flavor. And just sort of more broadly, I think she was an English major in college. I think her opinions are very easy to read. They're sort of conversational, much like some of the other younger justices on the court, like Justice Brett Kavanaugh, Justice Neil Gorsuch, and Justice Elena Kagan. But she has ruled on some hot button issues like abortion. And so, for example, one case involved talking a little bit about the role of the Supreme Court's precedent. She voted in a case called Price versus City of Chicago. So it's a challenge to a city ordinance that bars abortion protesters from going within 8 feet of women who are going into or out of an abortion clinic. And it was modeled on a nearly identical Colorado ordinance that the Supreme Court had upheld back in 2000. And so the challengers had argued that the law was unconstitutional based on two other cases that the Supreme Court had decided since then, one involving buffer zones at abortion clinics and the other one involving signs in a town. And just Judge Barrett joined an opinion that Judge Diane Sykes wrote that said, these cases have deeply shaken the foundation of the Colorado case on which this ordinance was modeled, but only the Supreme Court can overrule it. So, certainly she's written a lot about the role of precedent, and in this case, they were bound to follow it, they said.
Yeah. If you're just tuning in, this is the 21st. I'm Brian Mackey. We're speaking with Amy Howe, who's a co-founder of SCOTUS blog, which closely follows the U.S. Supreme Court, and Jeffrey Pojanowski, who's professor of law at the University of Notre Dame Law School. And we're talking about Judge Amy Coney Barrett. She's President Trump's nominee to succeed Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg on the U.S. Supreme Court. We've been talking about some of her opinions on the Seventh Circuit, the federal appellate court in Chicago. And Amy, you mentioned, appellate judges are more bound by precedent in their own district, what the U.S. Supreme Court has done. Do we have a sense from Judge Coney Barrett? I mean, there's this concept in judging called stare decisis, right, where you let the past decisions guide you into the present. But the U.S. Supreme Court is not necessarily bound by that if it chooses to go a different direction.
That's right. And so this is really a hot topic on the Supreme Court these days, even in cases that are not on hot button issues, when it involves overturning, the Supreme Court's prior precedent, it's really, every inch is fought, is fought. And so sometimes it leads to unusual results. The Supreme Court this year, overturned a 1972 decision that said that when you are tried in state court, you did not necessarily need to have a unanimous jury verdict. And Justice Lana Kagan was in the dissent in that case. And, you're thinking, you normally think of Justice Kagan as one of the more liberal justices, but I think she may have been thinking down the line about the role of precedent and Roe versus Wade. Judge Barrett has written about stare decisis and was, that was certainly a topic of conversation at her confirmation hearing back in 2017. She's talked a lot about sort of what kinds of interests might justify keeping an erroneous decision on the books. And among other things, she cited Planned Parenthood versus Casey, the 1992 decision that upheld Roe versus Wade as one of those decisions possibly. And so that drew a lot of attention at her confirmation hearings. But she also said at her confirmation hearings, or I think in the questions responding to discussion of precedent, that she was sort of talking about that more as an academic rather than as a judge. So there will be certainly questions at her confirmation hearings about precedent. I'm not sure we're likely to learn a whole lot more at the confirmation hearings about her views, because she will say, that she regards cases like Roe versus Wade and Obergefell versus Hodges, which was the Supreme Court case establishing a right to same-sex marriage, as settled law.
There's a script for nominees these days, right? Oh yes, that's settled law, and Professor Pojanowski, I want to ask you, because you clerked for both Justice Anthony Kennedy on the U.S. Supreme Court and Chief Justice John Roberts when he was still an appellate judge, and I think arguably those two judges are seen as more pragmatic, not necessarily subscribing to a strict judicial philosophy like originalism or textualism. And yet we've heard Judge Amy Coney Barrett saying that she, sees herself more in the mold of Justice Scalia, who was, of course, one of the, if not the biggest proponent of originalism. Do you get a sense of where her judicial philosophy might lead her that's different from the ways that the judges you work for would approach cases on the court?
Well, I'd be hesitant to kind of give predictions about particular cases, especially since she's a sitting federal judge right now. But I do want to I'll do this by starting to building on Amy's discussion, Amy Howe's discussion about precedent and stare decisis. And so Judge Barrett is an originalist, which means that she thinks the provisions of the Constitution should be interpreted, or the law, the law that these provisions of the Constitution make should be interpreted as understood, as how a reasonable reader at the time of enactment would understand them. So if you were a reasonably well-informed legal reader at the time of the framing of the Constitution, what would you think that meant? And that should be the law. Similar with respect to statutes, how would a reasonable reader of the statute at the time understand, the rule that the statute creates? That's very much in the mold of Justice Scalia, and I think she would be ruling along those lines. And there's a very interesting debate among originalists about the relationship between originalism and precedent. Judge Barrett's prior scholarship has entered that debate. And I kind of wanted to and one thing we can tell, or I guess, you know, some tea leaves we could read from her scholarship is seeing where she fits in those debates. There are some originalists and professors, usually, or a handful of professors who say stare decisis is illegitimate. An erroneous judicial interpretation can't trump the Constitution. If Congress can't violate the Constitution, the court can't. Therefore, you can't have stare decisis. Judge Barrett's writings have not fallen into that category, or I haven't seen anything along those lines. I think some of her, you know, the writings that people focus on is she's written a bit pushing back against people who wanted to strengthen stare decisis on constitutional grounds. She was making, a tentative argument for the current approach the court has, which on constitutional questions, which means you know, precedent certainly has weight, and there's a number of considerations that you consider, and those considerations were laid out in Roe when it decided to, in Casey when it decided to affirm Roe. So she pushed back against arguments that we need to strengthen stare decisis relative to what the court does in the Constitution now. But you don't get the sense from her her academic writings, at least, that she's one of the originalists who thinks stare decisis is illegitimate. And I don't know how she would particularly apply the traditional factors of stare decisis that the court uses in particular cases, but I don't think she'd spend so much time writing about it if she thought it were unimportant or irrelevant. Yeah. And certainly her writing has not been like, well, stare decisis is bad. Let's throw it overboard.
Okay. So, well, we're gonna continue this conversation. We need to take a quick break. We are talking about Judge Amy Coney Barrett, President Trump's nominee to the U.S. Supreme Court. We're going to continue the conversation in a moment here on the 21st. Stay with us.
The 21st is made possible in part by Busey. For 150 years, Busey has helped business owners and entrepreneurs navigate financial decisions, achieve long-term goals, and realize dreams of success. Busey, fulfilling dreams since 1868.
Welcome back to the 21st. I'm Brian Mackey. We're talking about Judge Amy Coney Barrett, who's on the Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals in Chicago, the federal appellate court for Illinois and Wisconsin and Indiana. And she is President Trump's nominee to succeed Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg on the U.S. Supreme Court. We're talking about this with Amy Howe, who's a co-founder of SCOTUS Blog, the website that provides detailed coverage of the U.S. Supreme Court, and Professor Jeffrey Pojanowski, who teaches at the University of Notre Dame Law School and was a colleague there of Amy Coney Barrett. We have listeners, if you want to join the conversation, the number is 800-222-9455. That's 800-222-9455. I want to go now to Paul in Urbana. Paul, welcome to the 21st. Thanks for calling in. What's your question?
Well, thanks for taking my call. When she was confirmed to the previous court, she wasn't, there was a lot made about her religious, her Catholicism, but she didn't actually specify that she was actually part of this People of Praise group, which I hadn't known about either, but it's a very patriarchal, small 1,700 people. There are a number of other groups like it. It's extremely patriarchal. I recommend people look into it because it's too complicated to get to a question, but I think it makes, that is fair game for discussion, it seems to me. I think it'll be manipulated, but I wanted to get the reaction of, both speakers there. Thank you.
Okay. Paul, thank you for the call. We appreciate that. Please call in again. I guess, Professor Pojanowski, I'll ask you. I mean, there's been a lot of discussion about Judge Barrett's Catholic faith, and I mean, we're not really sure how or if that faith motivates her judicial decision-making, and I mean, it's worth noting that Joe Biden, the Democratic nominee, is Catholic and pro-choice. Senator Dick Durbin of Illinois, who's on the Judiciary Committee, is also Catholic. I mean, I wonder rolled. So I guess I mentioned that to say that, you know, people who are of the Catholic faith are not monolithic in their ideology. I wonder, Professor Pojanowski, what role do you think her Catholic faith could play in her judging?
Well, I mean, she testified at her hearing that her faith won't interfere or, you know, direct, you know, affect the way she does her job. And I guess, you know, we could take her at her word on that. And also, I mean, one of the points of being an originalist is, or the aspiration or the goal of being an originalist is to try to take your own personality out of legal interpretation. You're trying the best you can to figure out how a reasonable reader thinks what this provision means, as opposed to what I hope it means or what result I would like to get. So her method, and again, people are human, but her method is geared towards trying to take her, you know, personal beliefs, out of the way. Now that you have personal beliefs for reasons for being an originalist, maybe you think, you know, the judicial role should be subordinate to popular sovereignty or what have you. But her method seems, you know, aspires to take those value judgments out of the way. And look, every judge comes from somewhere. Every judge has beliefs about what's important about the world and how we ought to live. I think people have started to realize, and a lot of people I've been engaging, including people who aren't thrilled about the nomination, that singling out of religion as being particularly disqualifying is not particularly productive. And as for whether, you know, people of praise or what have you, she does not seem particularly subordinated as a woman, if you ask me. And so if she's a member of a group that subordinates women, they're doing a very bad job of it.
Interesting. I do want to ask also, I wonder, I mean, you're a member of the faculty at a Catholic law school, mm-hmm. and Judge Barrett was, I guess, when she was not a judge, she was co-author of a 1998 article in the Marquette Law Review. And I should add, I've heard some subsequent reporting that she distanced herself from this somewhat, but at the time the argument was the Catholic, and I'm going to read from the abstract here, it says, the Catholic Church's opposition to the death penalty places Catholic judges in a moral and legal bind. And it goes on to say that judges may recuse themselves, but they're going to want to sit on as many cases as possible. And it concludes, while mere identification of a judge as Catholic is not sufficient reason for recusal under federal law, the author suggests that the moral impossibility of enforcing capital punishment in such cases as sentencing, enforcing jury recommendations, and affirming are in fact reasons for not participating. So, I mean, Professor Pojanowski, do you think that the church's moral teachings, not only against capital punishment, but against abortion, against the Iraq War, in favor of union rights? I mean, the church has a lot of opinions about a lot of subject areas. Do those teachings put Catholic judges in a moral and legal bind, generally speaking?
So I think generally speaking, no. If there's a real conflict, she drew a distinction between a judge sentencing someone to death, you're directly participating in it, and a judge who's, you know, reviewing the legality of a sentence, whether on the Court of Appeals or the Supreme Court, and sentencing is problematic in a way that reviewing is not, because you're not directly involved, and that gets into kind of interesting questions of moral philosophy. But you know, the conflict's going to be, would come, like, if I think, you know, personal beliefs cut one way and the law cuts another, if it falls in a range where, you know, no one in good conscience can affirm a law that does this, you recuse, and those instances are going to be few and far between. And in part because of so many questions that we deal with are areas of reasonable disagreement. And even if a place where, even if let's put it this way, there may be a difference between saying if a law, is to some extent unjust. The question is my participation in affirming it, direct participation enough that I shouldn't, and then you recuse. But most times, in most cases, that's, you know, not going to come, you know, going to come to the fore.
Amy Howe, I want to take a look ahead and kind of bring this section of the show to a close here. I mean, if Judge Barrett is confirmed, and we should say that the Republicans in the Senate have laid out a relatively rapid timetable for a hearing and a vote before the election. If she is confirmed, where could her nomination make a difference in terms of the Supreme Court's judicial precedents, both in the short term? I mean, there's cases on the Affordable Care Act and religion coming up, and in the longer term on issues such as abortion and other things that people are interested in.
Sure. So in the short term, you know, as soon as November, the day after Election Day, the Supreme Court is scheduled to hear oral argument in a case involving sort of how you balance religious beliefs and anti-discrimination laws. The Supreme Court had struggled with this issue a couple of years ago while Justice Kennedy was still on the Supreme Court in the case involving the Colorado baker who didn't want to bake a cake for a same-sex wedding celebration because he said he didn't believe in same-sex marriage and it would violate his religious beliefs to do so. And the Supreme Court, you know, didn't settle the sort of big picture issue of how you balance religious beliefs and anti-discrimination laws in that case. And so now it's back again in a different case involving Catholic Social Services and the city of Philadelphia, because Catholic Social Services won't work with same-sex couples. And so the city of Philadelphia has said to Catholic Social Services, okay, then we're not going to work with you. And then the week after Election Day, there is, of course, the Affordable Care Act, the challenge to the individual mandate, the requirement that almost all Americans buy health insurance or pay a penalty. Back in 2012, the Chief Justice John Roberts famously joined the court's former liberal justices to uphold the individual mandate on the ground that it is a tax. And then a couple of years ago, Congress got rid of the penalty. They said the penalty for not getting health insurance is zero. So Texas and some other states went to court and said, you know, if there's no longer a penalty, it can't be a tax. And so, you know, now, of course, Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg, who was one of the four liberals in the majority in that case, has passed away. And Judge Barrett, you know, has, at least in passing, you know, said that she suggested that she is skeptical of the Chief Justice's vote in the Affordable Care Act case. And then looking down the line, you know, on abortion, in the past few years, it was Justice Kennedy and then the Chief Justice who had joined forces with the court's former liberal justices to uphold laws regulating abortion. And so again, you know, if the court's liberal block is now down to three, it, even if the Chief Justice or another wants to join with the court's now three liberal justices, there might still, with Justice Barrett, be a solid five-member conservative majority to uphold laws restricting abortions. Gun rights, the Supreme Court has not taken up a gun rights case in several years. And the conventional wisdom is that there are likely four votes to do that, but the four conservative justices are not sure whether or not the Chief Justice would be on board with saying more about when you have a Second Amendment right to have a gun outside of your home. And, you know, perhaps with a Justice Barrett on the court, they might be more inclined to take up a Second Amendment case and have a more expansive view of the Second Amendment. And then finally, affirmative action. Justice Anthony Kennedy joined the court's more liberal justices a couple of years ago in upholding the University of Texas's consideration of race in its admissions policy. 2 weeks ago, I think, the U.S. Court of Appeals for the First Circuit heard oral arguments in a challenge to Harvard's admissions policy. The argument is that it discriminates against Asian Americans. And so that case could very well be back at the Supreme Court soon.
Amy Howe is the co-founder of SCOTUS Blog, which is essential reading if you want to follow the U.S. Supreme Court. We've also been speaking with Professor Jeffrey Pojanowski, who is a professor in the law school at the University of Notre Dame. Thank you both so much for sharing your knowledge and personal experience with Judge Barrett with us here on the 21st today.
Thank you.
Thank you.